One of the grand scientific projects of the 21st century is a go. The first council meeting of what they call the Square Kilometer Array Observatory has plans that will lead to the biggest telescope on Earth being assembled over the coming decade. The member states approved 1,000 pages of documents covering everything from the power to open up a bank account to engaging with industrial contractors. The telescope will comprise a vast formation of radio receivers in array, and they will be positioned across South Africa and Australia. That'll be fascinating. In a moment, Bob Bergman joins us back with us as we talk about, well, what could happen with celestial events that could affect planet Earth. One of his books, Earth Shattering. So we'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. George Norrie back with you. Bob Bergman with us, one of America's top astronomy writers, author of Zoom and the Sun's Heartbeat. He has contributed to the popular Night Watchman column for Discover for 17-plus years. Currently a columnist for astronomy, a host on the Northeast Public Radio, science editor of the Old Farmer's Almanac as well. Bob, welcome back. It's good to have you.
Well, thanks, George. Great to be here.
We have survived since the last time you were on, right?
Yeah, absolutely, and well, thank you for remembering it. Yeah, the book came out last year, Earth Shattering, all about the disasters that can strike Earth, and since then, I don't know if you even know this, and I'm only the third author on the one that came out this month called The Grand Biocentric Design, but if you'd like, sometime in the show, we can go from disasters to something else entirely, like good news about physics and how it all ties together and how there actually is no death.
Absolutely. Love to hear that. But, you know, I've always wondered, is it just a matter of when, not if, an asteroid is going to hit the planet?
Oh, you're right. Absolutely. Because happened before, will happen again. Yeah. Yes, absolutely. It was fun. When I was on the Letterman show, I brought up a handheld meteorite, just took it out of my pocket, plunked it on his desk, and he said, whoa, you know, what is this? Does this mean, like, there's one up there that has my name on it, and then I'm screwed? And, yeah, it's true. When it's big enough, it wasn't just that one 66 million years ago that wiped out 98% of all the life on planet Earth. It's going to happen again. I mean, we did get clobbered on February 15, 2013, or at least 1,000 people got injured. So a little taste of what could happen.
Was that the one over Russia?
Exactly, yes.
Yeah.
Chelyabinsk.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that was a concussion where they got hurt, right?
No, you're absolutely right. And nobody would have been hurt if they didn't go to the window to see what is that bright flash in the sky and that streak. But you can't blame them. Who wouldn't go to the window?
Exactly. Exactly. Where do the asteroids, Bob, come from?
Well, we think they're left over from the formation of the solar system, that the idea has changed since I was a kid. We now think that originally there's just small pieces of rock left over from the creation of the sun, and these crash into each other until they got big enough clumps that then pulled in other, through gravity, pulled in other clumps, and that's how the planets formed through what's called planetesimals. So leftover stuff that's still out there, that's the asteroids.
Could it have been from a planet that blew up?
That was the original idea. That was a great idea that we used to think in the 1950s, when I was a little kid, that we did the sci-fi thing. That then, of course, we were all afraid of nuclear war.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea was maybe there's a planet with an advanced civilization, and that's just what they did. They blew themselves up. So it was an interesting idea. But the physics shows that if a planet did blow itself up, you wouldn't have chunks that small. You wouldn't have them in orbits that they're in, the asteroids. They would be in a more of a concentrated single orbit, not all over the place between Mars and Jupiter and even throughout other parts of the solar system the way they are.
Bob, what would you say in our billions and billions of years of existence as a planet might have been the worst thing that ever happened to us?
Well, you know, there's bad news, good news, George. Like, even things like the great dying, the Permian extinction 251 million years ago, that killed more than 99% of all the life on Earth, eventually good things came of it. And the most recent one, the one that has all the publicity because that's what destroyed the dinosaurs. Yeah, the dinosaurs were destroyed, but what it allowed, famously, is that warm-blooded animals, small animals like rats, started coming, and we evolved from them. And so it was bad news at the time, but hey, it gave us rats and sitcoms, because here we are on Earth. So with rats and sitcoms, things can't be that bad.
What are planet killers generally?
Well, again, things like being hit by a giant comet or an asteroid, that in that case it was something probably close to 10 miles across that smashed just into the coast of Mexico, in Chicxulub, creating a big crater that's still there. So that's the that seems to be a planet killer in terms of the most potential for destroying life. The biological threats, we're of course in the middle of one now, doesn't do a great job. You know, we're sure we have over 400,000 people dead in America, but that leaves the overwhelming majority of us surviving it. A century ago, when the Spanish flu of 1918 happened, same thing, that had 650,000 dead. Bigger percentage of the population, because the U.S. population was a lot smaller back then, so that killed more of us. But still, the overwhelming majority survived, and so it doesn't seem it'll be biological. Now, nuclear war, that's something that's always talked about, but not everyone and not every animal is going to go extinct. That would be bad, but survivable. So most of these things, even Snowball Earth, the time when the entire Earth turned into solid ice going down at least a mile deep, there's no trace of land anymore. Nothing survived that. Everything, it was too cold. And once you're ice, you reflect the sun back out into space, and so nothing can warm you up. And we would have stayed that way forever had it not been for what came to our rescue that time were volcanoes under the ice that erupted and created holes and openings and warmed things up and changed the atmosphere, and we emerged from that. So it seems it takes a lot to kill Earth.
It does. It's a tough planet.
One way or the other.
Back in 2018, a total of almost 2.9 million Americans died of all causes, 2.9 million. So I look at these 400,000 tragic deaths with COVID. How many of them do you think really would have been caused by some of these other causes anyway?
Yes, I see what you're saying. It's a very, very good point. And that's why the statistics I prefer is when you look at the statistics of over deaths. In other words, you use each state's statistics to show how many deaths do we normally get in April? How many deaths from all causes, car accidents, murders, cancer, heart disease, how many do we get in May? And we look at those, but then this year you look at how many we actually had. What were the extra deaths? And then you don't have to start wondering, well, how many of the COVID things were from very old people who were going to die anyway, because they were right on the edge. And COVID kills, as we all know, that it mostly kills very old people and sick people. So wouldn't they have died anyway? Well, this is the best way to find out. You look at the number of deaths that actually happened per state, per county, per month this year, and you see how many more than what you normally get. And if you see over and over the same pattern, that's what we've seen throughout all the states, you see that there has been an overage of deaths throughout the country from all purposes, without breaking it up and saying, well,
right,
what killed these people? You just look at how many died, and you see, well, there were more deaths overall than we've had before, than we've had in a century. And so you figure that whatever COVID did, it did something, because look at these extra deaths. And that's despite the fact that there were some categories that went down. As you know, traffic deaths went down because fewer of us were on the road going to work.
Exactly. And flu deaths went down.
Flu deaths went down, and for a while at least, murders went down because people were not in bars.
Suicides went up.
Not too surprising. Suicides, drug use, yep.
Sadly. Divorces went up, all that stuff.
Yeah, that's a little surprising. I mean, you're locked in the house with your wife or your husband. You'd think you might get closer.
Instead, they went the other way.
Yeah, I guess so.
What would you say at this point we should be concerned about as a planet? Pollution, climate change, meteor hit, asteroid hit?
Yeah, George, I think so. They're relatively minor in terms of what could really, really kill us.
Exactly.
I know we're going to get flack from saying that that climate change is relatively minor because it does affect the whole planet, and it is real. And as it warms up, the sea level rises, and things that you can't predict are going to happen. Good things too will happen, of course, like much of central Canada may become farmland, which it isn't now, as things warm up. So you do have some good effects, but you have to have more bad than good, because that's any change in the biosphere produces that, because it takes a while for plants and animals to get used to new conditions. So because of that, you always wind up with more bad than good, at least at first. But that's not going to kill us. That's not going to kill humans. It's something that we would have to adapt to and live with, but it's not going to be like an asteroid hitting us. And pollution, who wants to swim in dirty water or breathe dirty air? That's, again, more of an issue. Sure, it produces more cancers and things like that. So that's just more like, taking care of our environment, our neighborhood. We want to be clean. We want water and air to be clean, and there's ways to do that, and so the challenge becomes, how do you do that without going crazy, without spending more money than it makes sense? Like, if you're going to alleviate something, and I have a feeling you agree with this, that you don't spend more money to alleviate a particular problem that then makes sense for
That's
that
right.
problem. You do things in a sensible way, and everybody will be happy.
Assuming there's extraterrestrial life out there, do you think they have faced some of these problems we could face?
Well, then, you see, this becomes so like making stuff up and guessing, because we don't know of terrestrial life or what form they could take. The most likely form would be, since there's more small things than big things, just in nature. There's more minnows than whales. There's more small plants than giant sequoias. So life elsewhere in the universe is more likely to be microscopic, something you'd only see in a microscope, or simple rather than complex, because, again, it's common sense that simple happens more easily in nature than complex. So before making the leap to think of aliens as being creatures like us, the first thought would be, if we ever do find life, unfortunately, it's not likely to be something that everybody gets excited about. People will be excited if we discover a world full of kittens or puppies, because they're cute, or scary things with big fangs. That's what's going to excite everybody. I wonder how people will react if we find that there's a planet around a distant star that has moss. The surface has lots of moss. Is everyone really going to get excited about that?
Probably not. Probably not.
Scientists will, but I don't know if the public will.
Probably not. Just send a lot of moth eaters down that way. The science of this is amazing. How'd you get interested in all this?
Oh, it's all my life. I have a feeling there's destiny in life rather than deciding deliberately. I mean, when you think about your life, do you really think you were going to be doing what you're doing now? Didn't it sort of just unfold in almost a magical way, and one thing led to another, and before you know it, here you are, and here I am. I know that when I was a kid, astronomy always attracted me. When I was a little kid, my first memory of my whole life is looking up from a carriage outdoors or a crib. Something. I don't even know. I don't think I had language then, but I remember looking into the starry night sky lying in a, I guess it was a carriage, looking out from the sides and seeing the night sky. It's the earliest memory I have. So you know, studying it in school, eventually teaching college astrophysics, you know, one thing just led to another. I mean, I was very surprised that I got into Discover magazine and became the astronomy editor of the old Farmer's Almanac. Those are things that don't normally happen to people. But I got those phone calls from the publisher 30, 35 years ago. That was a surprise. But it's been great. I interact with the public, and it's been a great life. You know,
I loved astronomy as a kid. I loved it. My folks got me a 3-inch refractor telescope, and I remember taking it outside at night on these chilly Detroit, Michigan days and just looking at the moon. But what really just captured my imagination, Bob, was when I put the telescope on Saturn and saw those rings with this little telescope I had. It was the most magnificent thing I've ever seen.
It is. And I'll tell you, now, after so many decades, I'm still just as excited to see those rings of Saturn. It never wears off.
And it was cool, too. You know, you name it at Jupiter, and you could see the four large moons around Jupiter.
That's right, yep.
And those just sticking out there.
The features. If you ever come east, you know, contact me and visit our observatory. We have two observatories here in the Dark Mountains.
Oh, cool.
Far from Woodstock. Come and visit, and I'll show you the universe.
One day we got to do some live shows out that way.
Oh, that would be great. That would be wonderful.
Super. What big cities do you live next to?
None. I mean,
not at all?
No, it's really, really... I mean, we see out the window, I'll tell you, we see a black bear probably once a month, just out the window, one window or another. Even cougars, which I don't want to see out the window, because they're not as...
They'll grab you, won't they?
Well, supposedly joggers, hikers, bikers, you know, have had run-ins, especially out west, with mountain lions. I think there's 5 different names for mountain lions. Do you know what they are?
No. Can we repeat them on the radio?
Oh, yes, yes.
Okay.
Cougar, panther, puma, mountain lion, and catamount.
Okay, and they're all for the same thing, the same species.
All for the same thing, yeah. A lot of names for the same thing. So this is really rural here. I mean, we're in an area where no one locks their doors still. No one. I guess I shouldn't be saying that over the air, should I?
No, it's not bad. Not bad. In your book, Earth Shattering, you talk about 4 Armageddon fears. What are they? That things that could happen to us. That something could pop in the next 20 years.
Oh, yes. Now I know what you're talking about. Because the Armageddon fears, by and large, are inspired by things that people should not be afraid of. We had one just a few months ago. That was when Jupiter and Saturn came together in that very, very close conjunction.
Oh, that was cool.
It was so cool. On December 21st, and those two planets came so close. They were almost merged into a single bright thing. Not quite. They were still two objects.
Didn't that kind of say that was the Star of Bethlehem?
Many did say that,
yeah.
Which is not valid, really. Not valid, but a lot of people were saying that. I mean, it was only a few days before Christmas.
It was ironic, that's right.
Yeah. But, so what usually happens, George, is that some astronomical event like that, or like Halley's Comet coming back, even though it won't come back until 2061 now, or a solar eclipse over, let's say, the Holy Land, that will come up in 2028, coming up just another 7 years.
That'll come up faster than we think.
Yeah, right over the Nile and those places. When something like that happens, and it's a real event, this is what always happens. Somebody writes a book or an article saying that it was actually prophesized by Nostradamus or by someone else, and that the prophecy was that this would indicate the end of the world. Armageddon. And people believe that. They buy these books or read these magazines and they say, yeah, the conjunction.
Mm-hmm.
Nostradamus said that this conjunction was going to produce the end of the world. We saw that in 2012, remember, with the Mayan calendar?
And we still haven't had the end of the world yet.
Yeah. And this happens over and over again. The end of the world never happens, but it's always like believe that this next thing. Remember, Heaven's Gate cult?
They all kill themselves. Bob, stay with us. I want to talk about the new book, The Grand Biocentric Design, when we come back. We're going to take your calls next hour with Bob Berman and his latest book, The Grand Biocentric Design. We'll get right into when we come back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. We'll take calls with Bob Berman next hour as we talk about all things space and science. The Grand Biocentric Design, what's the premise of this work, Bob?
Well, all three biocentrism books were really the idea of Robert Lanza, a doctor who, you remember some years back he was on all the TV shows for introducing cloning.
That's him. That's the guy.
That's the guy, and he's on Time Magazine's 100 most influential people in the world list. And well, it turns out we have the same literary agent, who's also, by the way, Stephen Hawking's literary agent, or at least before Stephen Hawking died last year.
And so
my agent said, this guy's trying to write this book called Biocentrism, but it's just not coming out well. Do you think you'd like to look it over? Maybe you can help. And I looked it over, and I believed everything he was saying already, which was almost a crazy premise, George, which is that our minds, our consciousness, our awareness is the basis for the universe, not the material universe, not the Big Bang, not the matter. In other words, it's not as if the Big Bang happened and then stars happened, planets formed around the stars, life formed on at least one of them, ours, and maybe many others, and then consciousness, awareness of things happened from life. No. The idea, and this started with the quantum people, originators a whole century ago, was that consciousness comes first. It's eternal. So just like right now, as we look around our rooms, we're seeing the walls, we're thinking things, we're hearing things, we're aware, we have experiences. The idea is that there's a parade of experiences that all of us have always had, and it never stops, and it never has stopped. There's never a time that you're not experiencing something. And you could say, you might say, well, what about in surgery? You were out during that time. But I could answer all of those rebuttals, but let's just keep it simple for now, because you asked a simple question. That's the basis of biocentrism, and it turns out it's also the basis of what they believe in Buddhism and Hinduism and what the quantum people believe. You know, the famous geniuses like Erwin Schrodinger and Werner Heisenberg and revolved around this. So in this book, this is the new one, the third one. I actually like the first two, Beyond Biocentrism and Beyond Biocentrism.
Mm-hmm.
This one has a lot more physics. And to critics who are saying, well, why isn't this just philosophy? This sounds like just philosophy. How do we know it's really physics and science? Well, this has chapters of equations and proofs that it's really real. And one of the takeaways, by the way, is that death is not real. So sort of as a bonus, you get relieved of any fear of death. So that's kind of a nice extra.
Well, and tell me a little bit about that. What exactly do you mean relieved of death?
Okay. So for those of us, most of us, who feel that this body is what life means, and when this body dies, then that's the end of things. I mean, we all hope that there's an afterlife and all the rest, but beyond that, that's death, when the body dies. I mean, you know, we have a dog that runs out on the road and gets run over by a car. You'd be crazy to say, oh, a dog's not really dead. It's really still alive. You know, that it would be crazy talk. So nobody is saying that these bodies don't die. It's just that through physics, believe it or not, and through quantum mechanics, you can show that what's really going on, what you really are, what you're really aware of, is awareness, which stays regardless of the body. There's no time that you're not aware of something. You're always going to be seeing and hearing and thinking. And that, when you think about your life, that's always been the case. Even when you did have surgery, let's say, yeah, they injected something in your arm and you got woozy, but the next thing you knew, you were waking up and looking around the room again. There's never oblivion. There's never nothingness. And so what we show scientifically, believe it or not, is that there is no nothingness. There's no end to experience. There's always going to be experiences. And so for those who may be listening and maybe are in bad health or God forbid, even worse than that, maybe terminal in one way or another, I would say, don't worry about it. It's never, you're never going to know oblivion. You're never not going to be aware of stuff and enjoying sounds, music, the smell of fresh-cut grass, the colors in a twilight sky, and all the things that make life life.
I've got to ask you this. What are your thoughts on God, Bob?
Oh, wow, that's a big one. You know, I get asked that on public radio. George, I usually dodge that one.
You're not going to dodge it tonight, I can tell.
Because in the scientific community, it's not popular anymore. God's no longer popular. It started with Descartes. The idea is that the universe is like a machine that operates by itself. And if you know what all the forces are, what's pushing and pulling on other things, if you know the four fundamental forces and can just figure cause and effect, you can predict what will happen in the future. There's no need for God. That was the belief starting about 150 years ago, and it's really spread through the sciences. Now, a lot of scientists still believe in God, but it's out of fashion. I don't have to tell you that. It's out of favor. So if I say, well, you're really pitting me to do this, I'll admit it. I do believe in God. I really do. I mean, like, without a doubt is the way I
feel. The question is the definition of what God might be.
That's right. So if we define God as all-powerful force behind nature, let's start with that. And if you look at nature, the architecture of the brain or the liver, the way animals fit together in their different biomes, how each creature fits in with others in the biome, and you look at nature, I don't think you could come away and say nature is dumb. It seems
no, it's brilliant.
Brilliant. Brilliant beyond anything we could even conceive of, let alone create. So at minimum, just looking out the window, you'd have to say there's a super intelligence behind everything. So at the minimum, if you call that God, and that's the usual definition of God, then of course God exists. And then the other question is, can you contact it? Does God know you personally in your life? Can you pray? Are prayers answered? And that's another issue. But, you know, we sprang up from nature. We didn't come here from another world. So if God is part of the universe and part of nature and exists through it and beyond it or controls it, and we're part of this too, then how are we separate from that? You know, why is it impossible to believe that that's contactable in our own lives? But I think the bottom line is, would have to be faith, because if you just do it logically, you don't necessarily come away believing in God, because there's the problem of evil. People could say, well, what about a child who's born with horrible diseases? How could there be a just God when you have things like that? And you know, you have to acknowledge that those arguments are powerful arguments.
Sure.
So I think it comes down to whether you personally, or whether I personally, have actually seen miracles, felt the presence of God. And I've seen actual miracles, George, actual miracles. So, you know,
I have to.
Believing, and that's why I believe.
I have to. And there's just too much order to what we call life. I mean, here's just a silly example, Bob. The human body has two eyes to see, a couple of ears to hear, a nose to breathe and smell, a mouth to talk and eat. Does that happen by accident?
No, it doesn't seem. And you know what? It seems silly to believe in the accident hypothesis.
Ridiculous.
Yeah, yeah. Fred Hoyle said that back around in the early 50s. At that time, people were starting, and this was before Crick and Watson discovered the double helix structure of DNA.
And the genome.
The scientists
That's
were
right.
starting to say, realize how complex life is, that you have a genetic code, and that how amazingly complicated and complex life was. And so Fred Hoyle said, to believe that this can just come together accidentally and you get life would be like saying that there could be a tornado that sweeps through a junkyard and assembles a perfectly working jet airplane, you know.
Well, and here's another one. We have vegetation on this planet. It's necessary. Trees, grass, everything like that. That needs water to survive. Who would conceive of rain to bring the water to these plants that can't go walking around and picking it up on its own? I mean, it's amazing.
It is amazing. And that's one example over, you could come up with a billion examples like that. So yes, there's an exquisite intelligence and I'd even say a creation behind it, because
yes,
you know, there are those, you know, here's an old example, is the makeup of the eye. And you'd say, well, the people who don't believe say, well, it just came about just through random chance, through accident. Some cell, just by mutation, evolved to be transparent, so light could pass through the cell, and that was the beginning of an eye. And once you had an eye, even a simple eye, you had an advantage over other creatures that didn't. And so early creatures that had these primitive early eyes were able to reproduce, and so eyes became prevalent. And there's the explanation. There, we've proven it. The problem with that is that you don't get an eye just from a transparent cell and a mutation that produces. You need much more. You need a nervous system that brings the light to the brain.
It's so all got to work in tandem.
Yes, yeah, but seeing light is no good unless you can move legs or arms toward or away from the light. Otherwise, you have no evolutionary advantage to it. So you need all sorts of other structures at the same time. And the idea that all these structures can mutate and come into existence, boom, all at once in some creature that gives them an evolutionary advantage to then reproduce, is inconceivable. And when you think of all the examples, it's almost silly to think that life could form by accident. It's actually not an explanation at all. It's almost stupid talk.
Exactly. And I think what also is the big question, not that it exists, but how it exists. That's the big question. How did this incredible design, this creation, this creator, how did it come into being?
Oh, and that's when we lose any answers, because there are some things beyond us, George, that...
I still don't get the Big Bang, Bob. I don't.
Oh, no, of course not. It's the craziest thing, because it had to have happened, and yet it could not have happened. Both of those are perfectly true. Why did it have to happen? Because if you trace back all the movement of all the galaxies in the universe, they are all coming from a single point 13.8 billion years ago. So everything was in one spot 13.8 billion years ago. Plus, if a Big Bang happened, you would have this cosmic background radiation, 2.73 degrees, made of microwaves, which is just what we see. You would have the same relationship of just having three initial elements, hydrogen, helium, and lithium, that we have. So for all these reasons, the Big Bang obviously happened. But once you've gone there, you're saying that the whole universe popped out of nothingness? We all know you can't get something from nothing, but here's the whole universe, started out as small as a marble, popped out of nothingness, and if you ask any theoretical physicists how that happened, they'll all say, we have no idea.
They have no idea, yet they think it happened.
Well, for the reasons I just told you, there's no other choice but that it had to have happened. But because you can't have everything coming from nothingness, it couldn't have happened. So that's where you're at with this. Had to have happened and couldn't have happened. So where does that leave the human mind with that kind of thing, George? There's a certain humility or humbleness that we have to have when we're confronting things like that. And they know it. Scientists know that the Big Bang is not really an answer. It's the best we can do. But there's all sorts of things like that. Maybe the biggest is consciousness. I mentioned earlier that biocentrism is about the fundamental truth or eternal nature of consciousness. But how do you get consciousness? I mean, this is the big one to me, George. This is the biggest puzzler, that right now we're all hearing, we're seeing, we're thinking, we're aware, we're experiencing things. Well, how does experiencing things arise from atoms of carbon and hydrogen and oxygen. How do you start with matter, even brain matter? mushy, but it's still made up of elements. So how do you start with carbon and hydrogen and oxygen, each of which are as dumb as gravel? They're dumb. Atoms of stuff are just like, they're dumb. How do you start from that? And okay, electricity is moving through it. But electricity is just the motion of electrons, nothing more than that. So you have electrons moving through atoms, and now how do you get the smell of new cut grass, the experience of that? How do you go from that to that guy who always wins the hot dog eating contest, in Coney Island? How do you make that leap from dumb carbon and hydrogen to experiencing music, experiencing love, experiencing colors? And nobody has the first step on that, how consciousness can arise. It's a little different from life arising, which is also a mystery, of course. But consciousness arising, awareness, being alive, the feeling of being alive, is the deepest mystery in all of science. Paul Hoffman, who used to be my boss at Discover magazine and then became a publisher of the Encyclopedia Britannica. I mentioned to show you that this is no dummy. And he would like to say that it's the biggest mystery, the most nagging question in all of science. How does consciousness, we're all conscious, how does this first arise? You know, the Hindus say that it arises in the fetus in the third month of pregnancy. But how do they know?
How do they know that?
Nobody
knows. You can't remember that in the fetus. Stay with us, Bob. We're at the top of the hour. We're going to come back and set ourselves up for phone calls with you. Bob Berman with us. We'll talk a little bit more and then take your calls. Jump aboard.